You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what he shows. G'day, everyone. Welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host, Warwick Schiller, and my guest for today is Kaya Twisselman, and I'm going to read you her bio here. It says, Kaya Twisselman, better known as Coach Kaya, is a California cattle rancher turned international motivational speaker on a mission to empower others to love themselves deeper, care for themselves better, and find joy in this messy, beautiful journey of life. After battling with a body image from a young age, she embarked on what started as her own personal health journey but transformed into the mental healing and self-acceptance journey she needed all along. Her story has been shared in People Magazine, Good Morning America, The Kelly Clarkson Show, Women's Health, and more, as she uses her struggles to give strength to others walking the same journey. Named one of Cowgirl Magazine's top 30 under 30, Coach Kaya uses her authentic vulnerability, witty humor, and infectious energy to show others how to overcome hardships and discover their inner vibrance to become the main character in their own lives. And having recorded this podcast with her, I can tell you that she has the authentic vulnerability, the witty humor, and the infectious energy. Kaya was so good to chat to. I wish we could have talked longer, but had a great chat with her. I hope you guys enjoy this interview as much as I did recording it. Kaya Twisselman, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. So why don't you start out by telling us what exactly it is you do in the world these days, and then I want to unravel how you got from where you grew up to what you're currently doing, because I don't think this was your career path you may have thought in the first place.
It definitely was not, and that's a good question. You know, I think that my answer continues to change and evolve, and I recently decided that that's not a problem. I don't have to choose to do the same thing for the rest of my life, and I can allow joy and interest to follow me. But what I would say right now that I do in the world is I am a motivational speaker and an event MC host, and I am on a mission to empower women to love themselves deeper, care for themselves better, and find joy in this messy, beautiful journey of life.
Wow. You've got some enthusiasm about that. That's awesome.
I sure do. I'm very, very passionate about it.
And so what I want to do is unravel how you got there. So where did you grow up?
So I grew up in rural California, and I know that maybe some of your listeners know that there are rural parts of California, but I love saying where I grew up and just seeing people's faces change, because so many people do not realize that most of the state of California is rural. And where I grew up an hour from the nearest grocery store, gas station. I had to drive 1 hour one way to go to high school. I grew up in a little area. You can't even really look it up on a map. It's called Carrizo Plains, but it's in San Luis Obispo County. Our family's ranch crosses over the Slo and Kern County lines. And, you know, looking back, I feel like growing up there, I was blissfully unaware of just how rare and precious a childhood like that was, and how precious it continues to become as, you know, folks get a lot less and less rural. And I think my friends that I had in high school and college, they would come and visit the ranch and they'd say, oh my gosh, it's like you grew up in a John Wayne movie. And that's a good way to describe it.
Yeah. How big is that ranch?
So, you know, I don't know the exact number, because this ranch is a partnership. I'm the sixth generation of the ranch. My nieces are now the seventh. And I'm really, really proud of our family's heritage and legacy there on that piece of land. But I know this is a big variation, but it's somewhere between 60 to 80,000 acres. And I say that, and people listening might be like, well, that's pretty large. But you know, where we're at, it is high desert terrain. We get 8 inches of rain a year, and there's not a whole lot to do there. It's a lot of marginal land, a lot of big, vast, open range lands. And so for what our family does, which I would say we do a little bit of everything, but largely we run cattle, it takes a lot of acres on a dry, desolate piece of dirt to raise cows. So it's sprawling, but it's not 60 to 80,000 acres where I live now, which is Kentucky. Very different places to compare.
Yeah, I grew up on, I didn't grow up in a place that big, but I grew up on 1,200 acres. And, you know, my normal as a child was, you know, you come home on the school bus, you get off the bus and you ride your horse around. And, you know, it's like that was my normal. You know, I thought that's just how it's done.
You don't see that very much anymore, do you?
No, not as much. So where did you go to high school?
So I went to high school in a town called Atascadero. So it is towards the coast, not too far from where you're at now.
Yeah, it's the next town, well, two towns south of us, yeah.
Yep.
And so that was an hour's drive each way?
It was. And, you know, growing up, I didn't think anything of it. I became really good at falling asleep in cars and riding the bus and getting homework done last minute on the bus. And I feel like when you drive a route so for so long, it doesn't feel as long as it is. But, you know, in high school, when I had friends come out to the ranch for campouts or, you know, parties and things we'd throw, they would always get lost. But it's mostly because they wouldn't go far enough. They'd think, I think I'm lost. I'm like, you're only 30 minutes in. Just keep going. I promise you're going to get there.
Were your directions something like, you know, turn left where the old oak tree used
to be? Exactly.
Well, that must have been cool growing up there. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
So I have two older brothers and my dad is one of eight kids. So I would say most of my cousins grew up out on the ranch with me and the other ones that didn't, they grew up just, you know, in what we just say in town. So closer to towns like Atascadero or San Luis Obispo. And so I was the youngest and the only girl, which obviously means I was the favorite. I'm kidding. But it was just really fun to grow up in such a big family. You know, our family functions when we have Christmas or Thanksgiving, there's usually 60 to 100 people, and that's just with our close family. And I think it's just really, really precious to be able to have such a tight-knit group to grow up. And we just have such great memories growing up on the ranch there.
I bet. Did you guys milk your own cow?
You know, we did not. Now, I would say the generation before me did, but on our family's ranch, we did not have any milk cows. We had all sorts of other critters, but no milk cows. And honestly, I don't think I regret that. Having a milk cow is a lot. It's a big commitment. You got to milk them twice a day. And yeah, I don't think I would have enjoyed that much, but the generation before me did. My grandpa always talks about having to go out and milk the cows. And I just think that's so cool.
Yeah, we had a cow when I was a kid and I was going to talk about milk because we just drank raw milk.
Yeah.
But if I went to town, like you went to visit someone in town or whatever, or I stayed over at a friend's place in town, you'd get to have what we used to call town milk.
Town milk,
on your cereal.
I love that.
Yes. And town milk was, it tasted like it had, I don't know, if it had sugar in it. I don't know, but it you know, pasteurized milk tasted totally different than the milk we grew up with. And what's funny is now, you know, we go to like Trader Joe's or whatever and buy raw milk and have to pay a premium for it. Whereas when I was a kid, like I just wanted some town milk.
Yeah. You thought it was extra special to have the town milk. Isn't that funny? Yeah. Our perspectives change.
Yeah. So we had somewhat of a similar thing growing up. So when you're in high school, what did you think your life was going to turn out like? What were you planning on doing?
I love to reflect back on this because, man, my life has taken so many more turns than I had ever expected. You know, in high school, I was an ag kid. So I was very involved in, I would say, all the things. I got really involved with peer leadership, which is where I think I discovered my love for counseling and people and mindset and just working with people. But I was also really, really involved with FFA and agriculture and sports and all the things. I'm definitely a people person, a bubbly person. I wanted to be everywhere. And in high school, though, I was very much like, I love the ranch. I love that I grew up on the ranch, but I don't think that I want to, you know, raise cattle for the rest of my life. I didn't think that that was my path moving forward. And when I was a junior in high school, I got in a really bad accident on our Kubota side by side. And those things are really hard to tip, but I can tell you that they can tip. And it ended up crushing one of my ankles and part of my other calf. And I was in the hospital for 8 days straight. And when I was in the hospital, I remember that there were a couple of nurses that just really made an impact on me. I thought it was so cool that there were these women that were able to consult the people that were hurting, that, you know, were sitting in a bed without having a shower. And I just remember thinking, that is so cool. I would love to be able to help someone one day. Maybe I want to be a nurse. And so when I was, you know, trying to decide what I want to do with my life, no pressure on 18-year-olds at all when you leave college, I thought maybe I'll try to go the medical route. And I was very much in between a handful of different colleges. And I was looking at UC Davis and San Diego State. Those were the two, and they're drastically different campuses, different vibes. And part of the reason I was looking at the two is because I didn't really know for sure what I wanted to do with my life. But I visited the Davis campus, and I can say with certainty that the reason I picked Davis was because they had cows on campus. It was like, you know, I might not be pursuing an ag major, but I need to have ag at my fingertips. And so I went to school at Davis as an undeclared biological sciences student, thinking, I'm going to start here. Maybe I'll go the medical route. Maybe I'll go to nursing school. And freshman year, I took a chemistry class. And that really just canceled out that dream so fast. Chemistry is not my spiritual gifting. And so I decided to shift once again in college. I knew that nursing was not going to be my journey for me.
Yeah, my son has a bit of a similar path. He thought he wanted to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And chemistry is what made him decide organic chemistry is money. Made him decide he didn't want to be a doctor. Like, I think you either get it or you don't.
I agree.
And it was like a foreign language to him. And so then he ended up switching his major and switching schools. So what did you end up doing?
So what I ended up doing was I went and looked at all of the different majors, and I was like, which ones do not require chemistry and do not require calculus? Because I knew that was not my journey. I think I realized in college that my spiritual gifting is the art of, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this on your podcast, but the art of bullshitting. Am I allowed to say that here?
You just did. So that's fine.
Okay, cool. And I realized that I had this real good, strong knack for writing. And, but I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I came across this major called human development. And a lot of people that went the human development route would eventually go into teaching or go into speech therapy, or maybe they would go into therapy or psychology down the road. And the human development major at UC Davis happened to fall under the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. Human sciences was just kind of slipped in there. And so it's so funny to me looking back, because in high school, I was like, I'm going to get out of the agriculture industry. I love it and respect it, but like, I don't know if this is the spot for me. And I kept finding myself pulled back into the industry at Davis. Most of my extracurriculars ended up being animal science classes. I took livestock judging. I took meats classes. I was really involved with our Young Cattlemen's Association group, Aggie Ambassadors. And I just kept feeling myself pulled in that direction. And I remember, I think it was my sophomore junior year of college, I went to this organization conference called Agriculture Future of America. And it's a national organization. It's kind of like the next step after FFA. They're not directly related, but it was this professional development conference for young leaders in the agriculture industry. And it was based in Kansas City, Missouri. And I had never really traveled much before. You know, I grew up on a cattle ranch. It's hard to leave the ranch. And so it was one of my first times ever going on a plane. And I go to this conference. And that was a really, really pivotal moment for me when I was in college, because it made me think broader about agriculture than I ever had before. Even though I grew up in it, I think I had this idea of, if I want to stay in agriculture, I need to live on the ranch. I need to raise cattle. I need to be involved in the production of agriculture. And it wasn't until I went to this conference where my mind was opened and I realized, oh my gosh, I can lean into my passion and my interests. And there is a space for me here in agriculture. If I love marketing and communications and I love working with people outside of agriculture, there is a place for me here. And so I ended up graduating UC Davis with my major in human development, and I had a minor in education. And the career path that I started after college was actually in agricultural communications. So it was an opportunity for me to use my writing, my marketing, and my people skills to connect with the general public, the general consumer, but on behalf of agriculture. And it felt like this perfect blend of both of my worlds into one.
And so where'd you go from there? Because that's not where you ended up.
You're
and
right.
That's the story I want to tease out of you is what were the steps along the way that made you take a left turn?
There were so many twists and turns. So I graduated from UC Davis, and at that AFA conference, actually, they had this opportunity fair. And it was opportunity fair where different organizations and businesses were trying to recruit interns and new hires fresh out of college. And there was an organization that was there called the Congress Bundestag Youth Exchange for Young Professionals, which is a mouthful. They call it CBYX for short.
What is the B part of that?
Bundestag. It is the German parliament. It's the name for the German parliament. And so,
okay, now can you tell me the whole name again? Now
yes, I understand what the Bundestag means. Congress, Bundestag, Youth Exchange for Young Professionals. So okay. Essentially what this organization is they are a grassroots organization, and it's funded by the US Congress and the German parliament. And their mission is to create grassroots transatlantic ties between the two countries by investing in, they have a youth program, and they also have this young professionals program for students or young professionals ages 18 to 25. And they were at this ag conference because their goal is they choose 75 Americans and 75 Germans, but they want to get a diverse swath of people. They wanted to kind of be a group of 75 individuals that could be representative of the nation. So they were looking for someone that was an ag student. They were kind of looking for someone just to check the box of an agricultural student. And so I had not studied abroad in college, and I thought to myself, this could be cool. And so I ended up applying. And I remember my interview, it was a 3-hour interview at the German consulate in downtown San Francisco. And I was so nervous. First of all, 3 hours. I had no idea what to expect. There was a German language test. I couldn't speak a lick of German. I knew the word kindergarten, and that's about it. And I ended up going, and I was selected. I was one of the 75 students that was selected. And I found out later, you're going to think this is funny. I found out later, one of the reasons that I stood out to them was one of the questions in the interview was, they said, okay, you know, moving to Europe, you know, it's going to probably cost you some expenses. How do you intend to fund your year abroad? And I said, well, I've got a herd of cattle that I've been raising since I was in high school. And my plan is to sell them off back to the ranch so that I can afford to live abroad. And they said they had never heard anybody talk about selling cows to move to Europe. And they just thought that was the coolest thing. And so they said, we just had to pick you. So cows are the thing that got me accepted into Europe. And I think what you'll notice is that cows continue to be a theme in every step of this journey that I went on. So I get accepted in this program. And the summer after I graduated from college, I moved to Germany. And this program was a 3-part program. It was 2 months of intensive language training, a semester of study at a university, and then a 5-month internship. So I lived with the host family for my language training. And then I moved to just outside of Munich to study at the Technical University of Munich. And I was at their agricultural campus. And my internship was for a big agricultural company called BayWa, and it's one part renewable energy, one part building materials, and then the other part was agriculture. And I worked for their foundation. So my role as an intern with them was I got to travel to rural elementary schools all over Bavaria, the south of Germany, and help them build school gardens and teach young kids about agriculture. And I just remember it was so funny.
Can we just back up a second? Because you skipped over something that would be like running a marathon for me. You learned German?
Yes. Now, if you quiz me right now, my German is ein bisschen schlecht because I have not been practicing it very much. But yes, I did learn German. So some of the students didn't know any German before they came. That wasn't a make or break. So I got to, I would say, conversationally fluent. I couldn't write an email without grammatical errors, but I knew enough to be dangerous.
Because it's a tough language. Like it doesn't really, you know, like if you learn Spanish or you learn Italian, you know, they kind of have the same Latin roots that our language does. And you can kind of read between the lines. But German, you look at it, you got, unless it says kindergarten, you got no idea.
You know, it was very intimidating. But I will say English is actually a Germanic language. And what I appreciate about German as a language is, when German as a language has a rule, their language actually follows the rule. Whereas English, we're like, we have some rules, but like I before E, except after C, and here's all of the exceptions where that actually doesn't apply. And in German, they're like, these are the rules and everything follows the rules. And so that made it a little bit simpler.
Germans are very rule followers.
Oh, in so many ways. And it was, you know, we actually had to go through cultural training before we went over to Germany because, you know, we were going to be moving in with Germans and they wanted us to understand just the differences so that we didn't go over there. And I think Germans get a bad rap. You know, they're seen as being these like really harsh and like angry people. You know, I think that there's this stereotype that Germans are cold and not nice. And what we learned, and I thought this was a great way to describe it. They said, Americans are like peaches and Germans are like coconuts. They said, Americans, we've got this like fuzzy, soft outside, you know, flesh where we're really sweet. We're really polite. We act like we're your best friend. We ask you how you're doing just because you're in the elevator with us. We don't actually know you. And we're just really, you know, soft and warm and kind until to actually get to know us, we actually have like a pretty hard shell, inner shell to be like authentically close with us. Germans, on the other hand, they have this like more abrasive, hard shell where you're like, okay, do they hate me? Are they nice people? Like, but once you break into that shell, they have this soft center and you are best friends for life. And I absolutely found that to be true. You know, growing up in a large family and a very affectionate family, I remember being over in Germany and telling my mom and dad, I was like, I just really miss hugs because my host family, when I first moved in with them, I thought that they hated me. Because they just weren't that like, you know, over the top, warm and friendly and welcoming. They weren't unwelcoming, but it was just different. And over time, I found it to be true that once we got to know each other, then it was like we build rapport and I had the best relationship with both of my host families by the end of it. It's just different. It's not bad. It's just different. And I found that definitely to be true. But I think one of the hardest things for me culturally is that Germans are not sarcastic people. And so certain humor does not land with Germans. And I'm a very sarcastic person. So I found that to be a little bit difficult, but overall, I loved it so much.
That's funny because Australians are very sarcastic.
So and sarcastic.
When I first came to America, I had to learn to, like, in my opinion, Americans don't do sarcasm well.
Really? You would hate Germany.
And so for an American to think that Germans don't do sarcasm well, Germans must be like a world away from Australia.
Oh, no doubt.
Sarcasm's a method of communication. Like it's an art form in Australia.
I agree. And every Australian I've ever met, I've never met an Australian I didn't like. And a part of it is because of their humor. I think that y'all have the best senses of humor, hands down.
Well, and the Germans don't?
You know, no, I don't think humor is where they thrive. I feel pretty confident saying that.
Yeah. You know, for me, I've been to Germany a few times doing clinics and stuff. And yeah, the language is, what's the word I would use? Abrasive. Like they always sound like they're angry even when they're not.
Yeah, it is. And it is different for sure.
Okay, so we got that. We've learnt German with the host family, and now you're going around to elementary schools.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, teaching kids about agriculture. So tell me the rest of the story.
Okay, so I'm abroad and doing my internship, and of course, like every American that goes abroad, I spent most of my weekends traveling to other countries and seeing all the sights because, you know, who knows if I'll ever get a chance to live in Europe again. And by doing so, let's just say that my little nest egg from selling my cows was dwindling very quickly and not keeping up with what I was making in my internship at the time. And so I thought to myself, okay, Kaya, like the real world is going to hit you fast. When you get back to the States, you need to make sure you have a big girl job lined up. And so I had got on LinkedIn and I was just looking for different job opportunities. And I saw this job posting from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. And it was for a job with the Kentucky Beef Council. And it was the position for their director of consumer affairs. And I thought to myself, okay, Kentucky, I've never been there before, but I think they speak English or at least a variation of English. So surely it can't be that bad. You know, beef, I grew up on a cattle ranch. This feels like it might be a good fit for me. So I applied for the job and my first interview was a Skype interview. This was pre-Zoom, was a Skype interview from a hostel room in Berlin. And looking back, it makes me laugh so much now because I Skyped in to this room of my future coworkers, my boss, who was an older gentleman from Alabama. And at the time I was a Californian with a nose ring living in Europe. Like I was a wild card for that job to say the least. And I found out later that I was only like one vote in the office away from not getting it. But what actually worked in my favor was the fact that I was a wild card. They were thinking like, okay, yeah, she might be a little bit of a different pick, but we need to shake things up. And so they ended up giving me an in-person interview. So when I finished out my year in Europe, I pit stopped in Lexington, Kentucky on my way back home to California for my in-person interview. And they ended up offering me the job. So I went home to Paso Robles, actually, for 2 weeks for the California Mid-State Fair. And then I moved across the country once again to Kentucky to work for the Kentucky Beef Council.
Well, we're still not getting any closer to to the, I was just looking at an article about you in something, and it said, after becoming an overnight sensation in 2020. So I guess we're getting closer to that.
We're getting closer.
Pivotal point there. But okay, so what came next? Because I think
you gave me permission to tell the long story, so I'm really telling you the long story.
That's good, because I really, before we got on here, I said that most people listen to the podcast get one of two things out of it. They get validation or they get inspiration. And validation to where, oh yeah, I thought I was the only one who felt that way or had that path or whatever, or inspiration, I could be doing more in life. And so the long story is probably going to provide some of those. So take your time. We've got plenty of time and I'm all ears.
All right. So I moved to Kentucky, once again, moving very far away from my family. My brother was so mad. He said, you just were gone for a year and now you're moving across the country. And I said, yes. So I moved to Kentucky and I start this job as the director of consumer affairs. And it was one of those positions where I felt like it was the perfect blend of my passions, right? I got to work on behalf of, they're not called ranchers in Kentucky. That was a big thing I had to break myself of calling. They're called farmers here. I got to work on behalf of cattle farmers in Kentucky, but I got to speak to the general public.
Cattle farmers.
Yes. They're not ranchers here.
In my lexicon, the way I understand things, if it grows out of the ground, you're a farmer. And if it lives on the ground, you're a rancher.
Now, listen.
So they plant their cattle there, do they?
They don't. But this is the thing. I think I expected the greatest culture shock when I moved to Kentucky to be, the culture, the people, the food. I don't know. I expected it to just be the area. And the greatest culture shock that I experienced was actually the beef industry, because I was the same as you. I said, if you grow crops, you're a farmer. If you raise livestock, you're a rancher. Like that's the rules, right? Well, once you cross the Mississippi River, the rules change entirely in more ways than one. So they're not called ranchers here. That is a very Western thing. So that was number one. Number two, I remember I had been working there for a couple of months and I was looking at a picture up on the wall and I had my cattle brand up on the wall in my office. And I was like, no one has invited me to a cattle branding. Do they not like me? Like, what's the deal? That's the way that we share with people and connect our friends and our community is through brandings out West. And so I remember I go upstairs to ask my coworker, Kelly, the accountant. I said, Kelly, what's the deal? Why has nobody talked about cattle branding? She's like, oh, Kaya, we don't brand our cattle out here. That's a Western thing. And that completely shocked me. I did not realize how drastically different the industry was from one side of the country to the other. Not only do they not brand their cattle, but they also very rarely gather them by horseback. They're more of a side-by-side state, I would say, or four-wheelers, or just gathering their cattle on foot. And also—
Okay, they're definitely farmers.
Right? It is. It's different. It's so different. And they also, I think it's rarer that you'll see, and I think this is changing a little bit now just because of fashion changing a little bit, but I also saw a lot less cowboy hats out here. That was also a very Western thing. There are more ball cap farmers here. And so, and I think something just to help wrap your mind around the differences is where I grew up, or we have these massive rangelands where we probably have like a cow-calf to 100 acres because it's so desolate. And we don't see our cattle every day. They are like on their own. They got to be good at hunting for water and thriving in the wild. Versus in Kentucky, the average herd size in Kentucky is only 25 head. And they can have a cow-calf pair on a couple of acres because they get that wet stuff that falls from the sky and they got all that grass. And so their herd sizes are so much smaller and they're so much more condensed. And so there's a lot of cattle farmers here, but just the nature of what their herds are is just, it's different than out West. And that was totally unexpected to me. So I'm in Kentucky. I am working on behalf of the Beef Council promoting beef. And it was a really awesome job for me as my first, quote unquote, big kid job, because it taught me so much about marketing communications. So in that role, I was the one that was in charge of all of our social media promotions. I did all of our advertising campaigns. I worked with influencers. I was the girl that on the morning news in Louisville, I would be the one getting up there and in a 2.5 minute segment, talking with the host, being like, here are two delicious ground beef recipes that you can cook up for your Super Bowl weekend. Like, I got to do TV and radio and it was so much fun. And I learned a great deal and really was able to hone my craft of public speaking and really media training in that role. And it was awesome. And at the same time, I started to get really, really homesick. Now I need to back up really quick because there's an important thing that I skipped over. And that is that the first day of my job or the first week of the job, I had just moved to Kentucky and it's the Kentucky State Fair. And I was setting up the booth with my coworkers. We had this educational booth at the fair that we partnered with the Kentucky Soybean Board. And its purpose was basically to teach the public, especially kids, about where their food comes from. So we're setting up this booth and these two ladies and a cameraman come up to me and they say, hey, we're doing ambush makeovers this year at the Kentucky State Fair. Can we steal you for one? And my coworker looks at me. She's like, yes, if you want to do it, like, go ahead and go do it. And my hair was super long. I didn't get it done at all while I lived in Europe. And I told them, I said, you can do whatever you want. Go for it. And so they chopped probably 12 inches off of my hair. So it was above my shoulders. They did a full makeup, makeover. And they had me on stage doing the live reveal on the morning news in Louisville in front of the full length mirror, like the full ambush makeover situation. And my thought was, oh my gosh, Kentucky knows how to welcome a girl to their state. And later that same day, my boss said, hey, Kaya, there's this livestock coalition meeting that's happening this afternoon. I'm going to have you go so you can meet some more people in Kentucky agriculture. And so I go to the meeting and I get the business card of the gentleman who's running at the time. And 5 years later, I married him. So I met my husband my first week on the job, the day I got ambush makeovered at the Kentucky State Fair. And if that is not the plot for a redneck Hallmark movie, I don't know what is.
You know, I don't know if you could be in a redneck Hallmark movie because the only redneck, you've got this California accent, but when you say Louisville, you go Louisville.
Louisville.
You do the Kentucky thing really good when you say Louisville.
Thank you. I've been practicing. I like to call myself a Kentuckifornian, actually. I've embraced both. But yeah, I ended up meeting my husband that day and he worked for the Kentucky Soybean Board at the time. So I actually met his mom that week for the first time too. So that feels like an important thing to mention. But fast forward, I'm working for the Beef Council. I'm learning so many amazing things. I love doing advocacy on behalf of farmers and ranchers. And I was desperately homesick. My oldest niece was born the week I moved to Kentucky. And so I felt like I was missing out on my niece's childhood. I was desperately homesick for the ranch. And I also wasn't making enough money at that job where I could just, buy a plane ticket anytime I wanted to go home. And so I felt kind of trapped in a way of, I am really far from my family and I also don't have the financial freedom to be able to go when I want. And I also don't have the time freedom. I'm working a 9-to-5. I can't just take off a weekend to go to California. And it takes longer than a weekend to go to California. And so while I was at that job, I thought, okay, this is not my forever job. What do I want to do next? And so it was at that time that I started my entrepreneurial journey. So I started a side hustle. So when I came home from work, after my 9-to-5 in the evenings, I had started this business with my future husband. He taught me how to use graphic design software in the evenings. He was self-taught. He taught me how to use it. And so we started this company called Burley and Barley Creative and Editorial. He grew up on a grain farm in Western Kentucky. And so they also raised tobacco. So Burley was kind of like a nod to his tobacco background. And on my family's ranch, we raised cattle, but we also raised barley. So Burley and Barley was kind of a nod to agriculture. And I started doing logo design and graphic design for farms and ranches and small businesses all across the country. And at the same time that I started this entrepreneurial journey, I had also started this personal development and health journey at the same time. There was a specific moment. We're getting closer, I promise. There was this specific moment.
I'm all these.
We were traveling from Lexington, Kentucky to Arizona for a work conference. It was for the Ag Media Summit. And I remember I was walking through the airport and I stopped into the bookstore and I grabbed this book that everyone had been talking about on social media. It was called Girl, Wash Your Face by Rachel Hollis. And at the time, I was someone that bought books, but reading them was another story. They just kind of like stacked up on my bedside table, you know? And I get on this airplane and I go to buckle my seatbelt and it doesn't fit. And I remember sitting there feeling mortified. And the flight attendant sees me and she's like, "Hey, honey, can I get you a seatbelt extender?" And I said, "Yes, please. Thank you." And the only thing I could do not to just burst into tears out of total shame and embarrassment is just to shove my face in that book that I just bought. And I think the timing was perfect because I don't think there was anything in that book that I hadn't ever heard before, but I think I was reading the message at a time when I was finally ready to receive it. And the thing that really stood out to me in that book was she had this conversation about it was your choices that got you here. And if you don't like where you're at, then it has to be your choices that get you somewhere else. And it was this light bulb moment to me that I had been playing a victim in my life in a really, really big way in all sorts of different aspects. When it came to my health journey, I played a victim to my genetics, thinking, well, I'm destined to never feel good in my body because I was, you know, just dealt a bad genetic hand. I blamed my job for not paying me enough money to be able to afford the fancy weight loss programs in the gym. I blamed my job for why I didn't have time to take care of myself. I also blamed my job for why I, you know, wasn't making enough money to have financial freedom. So I really had placed myself in this really big victim mentality and blaming everyone and everything around me for why I was feeling unhappy in my job, my career, in my health, in my body. And this book was just kind of this like loving slap in the face that was like, get out of your own way. If you don't like where you're at, make different choices. And that was kind of this, I would say that book was the spark to my whole personal development journey. And also my professional journey. I think it's actually really cool that I started my entrepreneurial journey at the same time as my personal health journey, because the root of both of those things I discovered was really rooted in mindset and reframing the way I thought about myself, the way I thought about the world, and the way I thought about the future. And so that is really where both of those began. I started working in the evenings, building this side hustle up. And I also started working in the mornings on my own self. I would make time to do free YouTube dance workouts in the morning in the living room. And I started journaling and I started becoming this person who binged podcasts, personal development podcasts and business podcasts. And I just started filling my brain with a different story, with a different way of thinking. And that is really when I would say the trajectory of my life started to shift. I started to feel myself having more of that freedom and building my confidence in what I could offer the world and what value I could have outside of just the traditional 9-to-5 role. And I also started feeling differently about myself and realizing that my self-confidence actually had very little to do with my body. And it had a lot more to do with how I thought about my body and the way that I treated it. And that was a huge pivotal change in my trajectory for me.
Yeah. I think the story we tell ourselves about ourselves is the big thing. And I think, at least for me, I was 50 years old before I knew I had a story I told myself about myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's so ingrained, you don't even know it's a story. You don't, you don't know that, you know, you have these thoughts about yourself that sink into your soul sort of thing, but they've always been there. And so you don't even, you know, they almost fly under the radar.
100%. And I think that's how a lot of people are operating. I think that the first step, I guess, in every journey is always self-awareness. And I think most of us were never taught how to be self-aware of, I think that we were taught to be self-objectifying and how we view ourselves and like the physical things or the money in our bank account or what we look like. But I think so few of us were taught at a young age how to be self-aware about our mindset and our thinking. And I feel like maybe that's starting to change with the next generation. I think mental health and wellness is more of a conversation, but the idea of, oh my gosh, my thoughts are not true and not everything I've thought about myself is actually reality and I can change what I think it feels so obvious now, but at the time it was, I mean, transformational for me. And I think it is for a lot of people.
Yeah, most certainly. And I think you kind of got to be ready for it, or you got to be, you know, like as the saying goes, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear.
Yep.
And it's just, you had one of those serendipitous things that you'd bought that particular book and then you got on the plane and the seatbelt wouldn't fit.
Yep.
You know, you could have bought that book and had the seatbelt fit and you might not have even opened it. It would be just on your stack.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
I feel like it's, I mean, no matter what you believe in, maybe it's divine intervention, but And I think another way to think about it too, is like, if you've ever had a moment where something hits you and you're like, oh my gosh, my mom told me that a decade ago and she was so right, but I didn't believe it until right now, because you're so right. I think it's, you have to be ready to receive and to change your own life in order to really make progress. And the people, other people can tell you until they're blue in the face, but nothing is going to change until you decide that it's time to. And it was just the right time for me. And in hindsight, I also think, you know, I think part of me sometimes mourns the childhood that I had, thinking what would have been different about my life if I had learned to love and accept myself earlier, because I struggled with my body image and self-acceptance since I was 5 years old. And that is what consumed me through elementary school, through high school, through college, and through my young professional life. It was this just constant cycle of shame and feeling like my body was a problem to be solved, and feeling like maybe this next fad diet is going to be the answer, and then shaming myself for doing it imperfectly. And it just continued and continued and continued. And I sometimes wonder what would have been different if I would have learned these lessons then. And at the same time, I just feel like sometimes you learn when you're supposed to. And maybe that struggle was something I was supposed to be given at a young age so that I could overcome it at a time when I could turn that struggle into something that could help other people too. Because I don't think I would be where I'm at now had I learned these lessons when I was in high school.
I don't think that's a maybe.
Yeah.
I'm fully down with, you know, all the traumas that we have in life are eventually what leads us to our purpose.
I agree. I wholeheartedly agree.
And whatever happened in life, I think, you know, looking back, like that sucked or whatever, but you know, mm-hmm. none of us would be where we are if those things hadn't happened. And think about, you know, talking about that story you had about yourself and all the judgment and shame and all that. At the time, you almost don't even know it's there. Like it's such a part of you that you almost don't know that there's another way to be. At least I think that way, you know.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think it just becomes our normal, right? It's just that's our status. And I think this is the thing that I think I tell people who are thinking about wanting to work with me in a life coaching capacity is, so many of us choose the discomfort of the status quo, even though we know it's not serving us. We choose the status quo of our thinking, of our habits, even though we know it's not getting us where we want to be, because it is familiar, and familiar is comfortable. So we choose that discomfort because familiarity feels safe. And the flip side of that is, instead, if we know that this is not what I want for my life, I know I want to change the trajectory of where I'm going, you have to then choose the discomfort of growth, choose the discomfort of thinking a new way, of trying a new lifestyle. And that is terrifying, because something new is not safe. And so often I think people choose that discomfort of familiarity and the status quo over the discomfort of growth, because change is terrifying. We don't know what's going to happen. And so we'd rather just stay here because we know what to expect, even if we hate where it's going.
Right. So you started out doing free YouTube dance classes,
yeah,
in the morning. What was the progression of changes? And you said you read this book.
Mm-hmm.
Were you following like a recipe? Like was there something in the book that suggested you do this and this and this and this and this, or did it kind of plant a seed? Because I remember, my son's 27, so probably 27 years ago, 25 years ago, I had someone give me a thing of cassette tapes. This is, I'm dating myself now.
I love it.
By a guy named Napoleon Hill. So Napoleon Hill was the guy that wrote Think and Grow Rich, but it wasn't that. It was called The Principles of Personal Success or something like that.
Yeah.
And I listened to them all and didn't do a damn thing about it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, decades later when my life made some major changes and I'd look back at that, I was like, oh, I did I did all the things he said to do, not even because it planted a seed. It's because I was passionate about the things I did and, I didn't know anything about Napoleon Hill.
Yes, I have heard of Napoleon Hill. Now, I wouldn't say that I'm a student of his quite yet, but if you have a book that you recommend I read, I'm all ears.
Well, no, it's just that his story was he grew up in a poor coal mining town in the Appalachians. Mm-hmm. And he, to try to get out of there, he went to like business school, learned to type or something. And he became a personal secretary for one of the wealthiest men in the country at the time. He was some sort of a railroad magnate, something like that. But anyway, he worked for him for the next 20 years and he got to hang out with, Vanderbilts and, all the wealthiest people in the country at the time. And whenever he had time, he would ask them questions. And he basically cataloged all the common denominators of things that they did. Mm-hmm. And these became these principles of personal success. And, one of them was like, not going a day without putting some mental effort into where you want to be. Another mm-hmm. one was having these little helpers, like, so it's mindset stuff. Like I'm going to the grocery store and I'm going to send my parking fairy ahead and he's going to get me a parking spot, which, in the 1940s, this is probably some weird stuff,
what I mean? Yeah.
But anyway, so this is where he got it from. He just compiled all these things that these guys had done to become successful and then figured out the common denominators. Now, at the time, they weren't reading a book and they weren't consulting with each other, but it turned out that all these people who were very successful
doing the same thing.
Did the same things. Mm. And so I read, I listened to those things and didn't do anything about it, but 20-something years later, you look back and like, I did all those things too. But then you realize you're doing it from not a place of I'm going to do this and it's going to get me where I'm going. It's this is what I'm interested in. This is what I'm passionate about. And I think when you have that interest and passion, those steps kind of can become obvious to you, or you just do it anyway, but you're not following the recipe. So that's a long ramble about, were you following a recipe? Like did this girl wipe your face, tell you what to do, or just sparked something in you?
Yeah, that's a great question. Okay, so I read the book in, I think it was summer of 2018. And this is when I started, I would say becoming a student of podcasters and people that were in the entrepreneurial and professional development world. And Rachel Hollis, the author, she had a podcast and she had this challenge that she put together called the Last 90 Days Challenge. And essentially what it was is the idea is, hey, instead of throwing away the last 90 days of the year because all of a sudden Halloween candy's out and it's the holidays and whatever, we'll start working on our goals on January 1. She said, what if instead, together as a community, we end the year, the last 90 days, our strongest with just 5 simple habits? And she called them her 5 to thrive. And they were really simple. It was, I'm going to see if I can remember them all. It was wake up 1 hour earlier for yourself, whatever you choose to do, but 1 hour earlier just to do something for yourself. Move your body for at least 30 minutes. Drink half your body weight in ounces of water every single day. Give up one food that you know doesn't bless your body and write down 10 things you're grateful for. So 10 habits that don't seem life-changing or like life-altering. And I thought to myself, you know what? I have done every single fad diet in the books. None of them have helped me. I'm just going to try, just because I'm curious, like what would happen if I just did 5 simple habits for 90 days and saw what happened. And so I did the challenge. I just did those 5 simple habits. And that's when I started doing my YouTube morning dance workouts in the living room. I decided that instead of seeing movement as a way I had to punish myself because I didn't have a great relationship with exercise, like PE was a scarring experience for me, being someone that existed in a larger body. And so I decided, I'm going to find a way to move my body that actually feels fun. And dancing felt fun to me. So that's how I started. And fast forward, after those last 90 days through the holidays, I had already lost 25 pounds. And the biggest change though, that I would say is that I was more confident in myself than ever mentally and emotionally, because I became someone who showed up and did the things that I said I was going to do. And that is really where things started to shift for me. And it was the first time in my life in 2019 that I didn't feel like January 1, I was making these big empty promises to myself like I did every year before. It was just about, I'm going to continue to do the things that make me feel good physically, mentally, and emotionally. And I continued going on with this. And at the time, I was doing my Burley and Barley business. I had convinced my husband to apply for a job in my hometown in San Luis Obispo for the San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau. And by some miracle, I got the Kentucky boy to leave the South, which is not an easy ask, mind you. He applied for the job and he accepted it. So in February of 2019, we moved back west where I'm from to San Luis Obispo. And at that time, I decided, you know what? Instead of getting another job and continuing to work on this side hustle, I'm going to give myself 6 months to see if I can build my side hustle up so that it can sustain me and support our family. And so I went all in on entrepreneurship and all in on my personal development and personal health journey. And I just started sharing about it on social media. And so my business was growing. It took lots of different turns. I would say that I'm a yes girl. So I did everything from graphic and logo design to a website design to social media marketing to photography to editorial writing. I actually did an article on a group of Australian farmers who had come to California to go to the Agriculture Technology Summit. And I got to hang out with them for a whole week and write an article for them. And that was really fun. And I also got into watercolor illustration, which I didn't even know I had a talent for, but someone asked if I could do a watercolor logo for them. And I said, yeah, let me give it a try. And I was pretty good at it and people kept coming back for it. So I kind of found this niche in watercolor illustrating. And so my business is growing. And in terms of the personal development stuff, I'm just sharing about what I'm learning on my own channels with no intention of it going anywhere, just feeling really, really passionate about the way that it was impacting my life. And I just wanted to scream it from the rooftops. Like, this mindset stuff is the real deal, y'all. And so I started talking about it, and a long story shorter, the folks that work for National Cattlemen's Beef Association, who I developed a relationship with when I worked for the Kentucky Beef Council, they reached out and they say, hey, Kaya, we love your story. We love that you're media trained. We love that beef continues to be a part of your diet. And we would love to pitch your story. And at this time, I had lost over 100 pounds in less than 1 year. And it is 2020 at this point in time. And so NCBA decides that they want to pitch my story to media. And I said yes, because I'm a yes girl. And I had no idea where it was going to go or what was going to happen or if anything was going to happen. And I found out that the story they were pitching me to was People Magazine. And People Magazine decided to put me in their summer of 2020 transformations issue. And I think this another thing about it was kind of like the perfect timing. You know, imagine summer of 2020. Magazines and media outlets are not able to go out and capture stories and bring people into their studios to do big, you know, photo sessions and all of these things. And I had documented my journey from day one so well. So I had an archive of photos and videos and behind the scenes of me on my personal health journey that I didn't do intentionally, but maybe in the back of my mind, I knew that there was going to be something to it. And so when People Magazine heard the pitch and they also found out that I had all of the creative assets to just hand them to make the story, it was a pretty easy sell, I think, for NCBA. So People Magazine ran my transformation story in their 2020 summer issue. They pitched it to Good Morning America. So my personal health journey was on Good Morning America. It went to Access Hollywood, to Women's Health. It had this crazy snowball. And I think one of my proudest moments was on Access Hollywood, they actually published me saying, and my favorite diet food is beef. And that is something you do not hear in Hollywood very often. So that felt like a big advocacy win. And suddenly, you know, I went to bed the night before the article came out with like 4,000 followers, which was exciting and amazing. And I couldn't believe that many people cared what I had to say. And I woke up the next morning to 17,000. And so it really did feel like, oh my gosh, overnight, I had this platform suddenly. And at the time, I had already been starting to do some life coaching on the side in private, because people would reach out to me independently and say, hey, I love what you're doing. Would you be open to coaching me? And because I'm a yes girl, I said, sure, I don't know what that means, but I'll give it a try. And I really had fallen in love with coaching behind the scenes. And suddenly everyone wanted to work with me. So I asked myself, do I want to continue doing marketing and communications, or do I want to go all in on coaching and pivot a little bit? And so I decided to work through my contracts. You know, I was working with some really awesome clients that I love, like Harris Ranch Beef Company, the largest feedlot in California. I was doing the marketing communications for them and I loved it, but I was like, listen, we're going to work through the end of the contract. And then I'm shifting. I decided that I wanted to go all in on being Coach Kaya instead, because that's really what was pulling my heart that direction. And so summer of 2020 is when I decided to go all in on coaching and being a speaker. And the way that I became a speaker was really just by people asking me to speak and me continuing to say yes to opportunities. But I think the moment that I really felt like, oh my gosh, like I am a speaker, like I want to really do this, was the spring after that, in April of 2021, NCBA again was like, hey, Kaya, we have another pitch. Can we pitch your story? And again, I didn't know what they were pitching it to. And they pitched my story to the Kelly Clarkson show. And the world had started to open up at this point. And so I got to actually go down to Universal Studios into studio and be on her show. And she's interviewing me on air and she was so lovely. And she asked me, you know, like, tell me about your story. How did this all happen? And I told her about the book and she said, well, there's someone here that wants to meet you. And so out from behind the backstage screens, Rachel Hollis, the author of that book that was really the catalyst for my journey, comes out from backstage and comes out and I get to meet her in person. And it was still a little COVID-y, so I wasn't allowed to like hug her on camera. But it was just this like total full circle moment. And what was really sweet in the deal was when, after we were done filming or whatever, she had invited me to come to her women's conference as a VIP guest, which was amazing. I was so excited. But then when I met her backstage and we were just talking candidly, just girl to girl, she stops and she's like, wait a second, do you want to be a keynote speaker at my conference? And so she had spontaneously invited me to be a keynote speaker at her conference. This is Rachel Hollis, the author. And so she invited me to come to her conference to be a keynote speaker. And I think I thought at the moment, I was like, this is too good to be true. She's not going to remember it. Her people aren't going to know to reach out to me. Don't get excited, Kaya. It might not ever happen. And fast forward, I got to be a speaker on her stage at her women's conference. And I got to do the whole, like, I had the Britney Spears microphone. I had like the big LED wrapped screen around me. I had the walkout song, like fancy cameras. And I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, have I made it? Is this it? And I think that that speaking event, I'd done plenty of speaking beforehand, but that was the time when I really realized I really love this. I really love being able to use my story to inspire and empower other people. And I really love speaking and performing on stage. And that's when I really decided to go all in on Coach Kaya as a speaker.
Wow, that's an awesome story. So what was Kelly Clarkson like?
So I didn't get to hang out with Kelly Clarkson that much. You know, I got to come in from backstage and we got to chat in between takes and whatnot. But my experience of Kelly Clarkson was that she was a delightful and lovely human. She was so kind. She's from Texas. So she like vibes with the ranchy side of things. But one of the things that I really, really respected about her was when we, in between takes, she really treated everyone on her set and her crew like family. Like they were just all really tight knit and close. You know, she was asking people about how their kids were doing or how their recent play went. And I just really respected that, because I think we hear a lot about people in Hollywood being different than we imagine them to be. And so I'm always wary when I meet someone that I, you know, look up to so much. But my impression of her, she made a great impression on me. Again, I didn't get to, you know, have dinner with her or anything, but she was wonderful. Right.
And that's cool that they organized the whole Rachel Hollis thing. They did.
I was the only one that didn't know. Everyone else was in on it, but it was a really cool surprise.
Yeah, that's doing your homework and researching the story and
100%.
And you know, organizing some stuff. That's super cool. So okay, so where did it go from there? Like,
so at this point in time, 2021. I am coaching and I am speaking full time and I'm really, really loving it. And I realized at the time I love working with women one-on-one, but I only have so many hours in the day. And so I ended up creating a digital course and also a membership community so I could support more women at once who were really on this health journey that wanted to focus more on the mindset aspect of it. So I think most people at that time were coming to me because they had seen my before and after picture and they wanted to lose weight too. And so I remember when I first started, I actually positioned myself as a weight loss coach, which things have really changed in my personal brand since then. And I just really wanted to help people break out of the fad diet mentality and focus on health promoting habits, but really focus first on learning to love and accept themselves in their skin. Mm-hmm. And I found so much joy from it, but I also got really, really burnt out, especially when I had a membership community. I think so much of my entrepreneurial journey is learning how to honor my own energy. Because I'm a go, go, go and a yes girl, I got to a place where I was really, really burnt out and had to press pause on it. And so I pulled back from coaching in that capacity for a while. I did some of my own deep internal work and continued, you know, to speak on stages and whatnot. And what I think has been really, really cool about my speaking career is while my message is very broad and general, I speak mostly to women, but to broad audiences, and it's all about mindset. A lot of the groups that I speak to are agricultural groups. So I speak to women in ag organizations. I speak to young farmers and ranchers organizations. And what has been so neat for me is to realize that maybe my role in the industry isn't in production agriculture like I was raised in. Maybe it's not even just in marketing communications, but maybe my role in the industry is empowering the people within it to love themselves deeper and take care of themselves better. And that has been wildly rewarding for me. You know, I grew up in a family where we didn't, not just my immediate family, but my you know, extended family, we didn't talk about emotions. I never saw anybody share their emotions. I never saw anybody talk about their struggles. And I come from a family that struggles a lot with addiction and alcoholism because of it. And I just feel really, really passionate about helping to change that legacy and helping to have mental health be more of a conversation. And in terms of the body confidence side of things, I really want to change the legacy for my nieces. You know, my branding has shifted a lot since I marketed myself as a weight loss coach. And what I say now is I don't give a hoot if you lose weight, gain weight, or however your body changes. What I care most about is that you learn to love and accept yourself in your skin, that when you do take care of yourself, you do it from a place of love instead of punishment, and that you allow yourselves to show up for your life and stop sitting on the sidelines because you're ashamed of what your body looks like. There is this really alarming statistic where 70% of adult women report having withdrawn from activities because of their body image. And while it's heartbreaking, it's not shocking. You know, I remember seeing my mom very rarely ever get into the pool with us or go into the ocean with us as kids because she didn't want to wear a swimsuit. I very often see women who are not doing the things that they want to do because they're so self-conscious in their skin. And it breaks my heart not only to think about how much of our lives we're wasting for no good reason, but also what we're continuing to perpetuate and teach the next generation of little girls, that you aren't worthy of living your life fully, especially if you look like me. That's the message we're sharing. And that's what I really am passionate about stopping. And I think the way that we heal the world, I think the way that we heal and provide something different for the next generation is really by healing our relationship with ourselves first. And that's what I'm deeply passionate about in terms of my coaching capacity is, how can I help spur women's confidence so they can show up fully for their own lives and give other people permission to do the same?
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, I think, you know, something that's always bugged me is like, if you look at the front of any women's magazine, there'll be a guilt-free recipe on there. And which means they take all the fun out of the food, and now you can eat this without feeling guilty. Like if you didn't take the fun out of the food, you should feel guilty. And I am really big on the belief that I'll tell you what, years ago I worked for a wealthy family, and the guy that the husband, he used to have his gardener grow wheatgrass, and he used to do these wheatgrass shots. And I was up at the house one day, and he said, "Hey, you want to do a wheatgrass shot with me?" And so he does all his juicing of his wheatgrass shots, and he gets these two shots there. And I said, "Sure." I said, "You go first." So he gets his wheatgrass shot, and he kind of picks it up and holds it in his hand, and then he closes his eyes, and I don't know if he's praying or mumbling or what he's doing. Anyway, then he drinks the wheatgrass shot, and I said, "What was all that little conversation you had with yourself before that?" And he goes, "Well, the thing about wheatgrass is it's so bitter, like it tastes so bad that if I don't tell my body that it's good for it, it'll actually reject the nutrients in it because it thinks it's bad." And I said, "Well, see, that's the reason I don't have to drink wheatgrass." I said, "When I eat a big fat juicy steak with a big bit of fat on the side of it, I think this is the most nutritious thing my body can take in right now and it takes it in as such. And he looked at me, goes, well, that doesn't work. That's not right. And I said, well, if what you said's right, what I said's right. And I believe that if you eat something and you have a, you know, you have an energy about eating it, you have a negative energy about eating it, it's got to, I think it's got to affect you in a certain way. I'm, you know, just your mindset of it. I mean, if you can have two different flowers or whatever in your house, and one of them you always say I love you to the flower, and the other one says I hate you, and one's going to die. I mean, there's an energy in that perception of something. I think, and you know, and women are taught to, you know, this whole guilt-free thing. That's always kind of irked me about, you know, like the covers of women's magazines and stuff.
Yeah. I think that all of us, and I know I talk a lot about women, and I know that men struggle too, but I think women struggle maybe more. Maybe that's not a fair thing to assume, but, and I think from the time we're really, really young, we are just trained and conditioned to believe that our bodies are problems to be solved. And everywhere we turn, there is someone selling us a solution. And so we're hardwired to see these flaws and these things that we need to change. And I even see this with like the whole anti-aging movement. I am very much like, if it's your body, do whatever you want with it. I am not going to judge you. And at the same time, it just really surprises me how many women I know that are my age and how common Botox is. And like, I have nothing against Botox. Do whatever you need to do. But I just think, is anti-aging part of this new like diet culture mentality a little bit? We're taught to believe that having a body that looks like it's aging is a bad thing now. I just think like it's another way that we're kind of conditioned to believe that anything about our body is something to be fixed. It's something that really shocked me this last year. My husband was putting together an event for the Slo County Farm Bureau's 100-year anniversary. So he was looking through old newspaper clippings and things to kind of categorize the history of the Farm Bureau. And there was a clipping he pulled from 1953. And it was, what it said was that the Slo Farm Bureau just started their new program, Fatty Anonymous, for women 20 to 85 pounds overweight. And my jaw hit the floor. And then after I saw it and I thought about it, I think this is why my grandma, who is 90 years old, has been on a diet ever since she was a little girl. And she still is on a diet at 90 years old because this is the generation she was raised in. And it breaks my heart to think that at 90 years old, she still weighs herself every single morning. And I'm like, when I'm 90, I hope that is the last thing that is consuming my brain. And I just think that, of course we struggle with our bodies. I mean, look what the odds have been really against us. And I just am really, really passionate about changing that conversation. And I think that we've been taught that our happiness, our worthiness, and our self-love and confidence comes from having the perfect body. And what I know to be true is that our self-confidence, our self-love, our worthiness has absolutely nothing to do with our body. Because I know, even speaking for myself, I have gained weight since I lost my big weight, since my big before and after weight loss transformation. I've gained weight back. And I am more confident than I've ever been in my entire life. And I would say that maybe at my thinnest, I was still the most self-judgmental, because you'll always find other things that are wrong with you if you're not able to realize that, oh, I am worthy of love and acceptance and joy and confidence, regardless of how my body continues to change, because it is ever evolving and ever moving.
Yeah, I think that, you said something there about, you know, no matter how much weight you lose, you think you need to lose more or whatever. I went to it was actually a plant medicine ceremony in Florida a few years ago. And there was probably 50 people there, I think, at this weekend. And there was a lady there from Brazil. And it was funny, her 18-year-old son was there too. And he said, it's so interesting that it was her second time going there. And her son said, to me, it's so interesting that my mom's back here. Like, when I was in high school, she found some pot in my sock drawer and she called the cops on me, you know, like she's totally against anything like that. And here we are it's an ayahuasca ceremony, but this woman, she had what most women would call the perfect body. the person. So she's this Brazilian lady. When she walked by, men and women's heads just swivel and follow her and like look from the top to the bottom to the top again. Like, wow. Anyway, so the son was telling me, yes, the reason she came to her first plant medicine journey because she suffered from severe depression. And so she has the body that every woman on earth thinks, if I had that body, I'd be happy. And she's suffering from severe depression. So it's, you know, yeah, it's
you know, there's actually a term for it in psychology. It's called the arrival fallacy. And I also like to call it the lie of once. And I think that all of us have a different flavor of what the lie of once is. So for me growing up, my lie of once was, I'll finally love myself and feel confident in my body once I lose the weight, right? And maybe for other people, it's, I'll finally feel secure once I have so much money in my bank account. I'll finally feel successful once my business reaches a certain level. I'll finally feel content once I finally own my house. I'll finally feel loved once I'm finally in the relationship. Whatever this once is, there's all sorts of different flavors of it. And in psychology, they call it the arrival fallacy because it's this false notion that once we reach a certain level of achievement, we will experience enduring happiness. And they did this really fascinating study on movie stars and Olympic athletes, and they looked at their mental and emotional well-being before and after they achieved the pinnacle of their career. So before and after they won the Oscar, the Emmy, whatever the award was, and before and after they got the Olympic gold medal. And they actually discovered that their mental well-being after they reached, you know, the peak of the mountain, the number one goal, was far worse. Because we put all this emphasis on everything in my life is going to shift once this one thing happens. And the truth is that once you get a gold medal, once you stand on a scale and hit your goal weight, once a certain number pops up on a screen in your bank account, you are the same person with the same brain, with the same way of thinking, and our circumstances don't change the way we feel about ourselves. And so often the thing that we want most isn't actually the thing that we want to achieve. It's the feeling that we believe achieving it will give us. What I wanted, I thought, was weight loss. I didn't want weight loss. I wanted to love myself. I wanted to accept myself. I wanted to feel confident in my skin. And when I finally realized, oh, I don't need to wait until my body changes to feel those things, and I can create those feelings and emotions right now without changing a single thing about my life, that is when everything changed. And that's when I felt like I kind of put myself back in the driver's seat again, instead of playing victim to these circumstances that I may or may not ever achieve, knowing that if I achieve them, it's not actually going to give me the thing that I want that's deeper than the achievement itself.
What you just said then is the thing. Like what you just said right then, that's the thing. I read a book a few years ago. It was called Backbone, and it was a men's self-help sort of a book. You know, he starts out saying that a lot of the self-help revolution was aimed more towards women. And so this guy had done a lot of, you know, men's work, stuff like that. And so he wrote this book, but he said in this book that most men spend all their life thinking, I'll be happy if I can just get these four things. And these four things are material wealth, vocational success, love, and health. Mm-hmm. And most guys die unhappy because they never got all four of those. If I could have just got all four of those at the same time, I'd be happy. And he said some people actually get all four of those at the same time. And it's just like you said, winning the Olympic gold medal, it's, I've got those four things and I don't feel any different. And he said, so then the real work begins. He said, then you've got, there's three things you've, after that, there's three things you come to realize you do need to have. Number one, you need to know your purpose. Why are you here? Number two is you have to have a deep and authentic spiritual belief. Doesn't have to be organized religion, but you have to have a deep and authentic spiritual connection to something larger than you. And number three is you got to get rid of your bullshit.
Yep. Yeah.
But that thing you talked about, that, what did you call it? The
arrival fallacy.
But what did you call it?
The lie of once.
The lie of once. Yes. Once I get. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's super cool.
Yeah.
That is awesome. And you know, there's actually a, they've done a study. There's a, like, as far as money, there's a cutoff point to where, like, if you're below that cutoff point, yes, more money would make your life happier. But once you get to that point, more money does not make you happier. Or as Mike Tyson once famously said, anybody who thinks having a lot of money will make you happy ain't never had a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. And it's so true. It's so true. You know, you brought up figure out your bullshit. And I have to come back to that because I'm someone who, you know, grew up on a cattle ranch. I also have two older brothers. And so I'll confess, I think poop jokes are funny. I promise this is going somewhere good. So I mentioned that I was a watercolor illustrator before, and I was actually looking to see if I could find one in my desk. I'll have to send you a picture, but I had painted this picture just for myself, not for any other reason. And it's a picture of a cow facing away, and behind the cow is a big pile of cow shit, crap, whatever we call it. And growing through it are these two daisies. And underneath it, it just says grow through it. And it's a metaphor, right, for life. And I actually turned this poop joke into one of my keynote speeches. So if anybody's ever heard me speak somewhere, the whole punchline at the very end is all a poop joke. And I first, before I show them the picture, I just have a picture of just a juicy cow patty on the screen. And I just pause and wait and everybody giggles. Anyone that says they don't think poop jokes are funny is lying to you. And everyone giggles, right? Because it catches them off guard. And I say, now what is that? And of course, everyone's like, you know, it's crap or whatever. But in agriculture, we know that that's manure. And it's also one of the greatest organic fertilizers in the world. And the truth is that all of us, life throws crap at us that we didn't ask for, right? Things that we cannot control that are completely outside of our control. Whether it is, you know, the weather in agriculture, that's something you can't control, a global pandemic, a loss in the family, a sickness, whatever these things are, sometimes we are dealt a crappy hand, all of us. Different flavors of it, but all of us are dealt a crappy hand at one point or another. And what I believe is true is that when you're in the thick of it, yeah, it just stinks. It does. When you're in the thick of the crap, it just stinks. But what I also know to be true is that in that crap, in that manure, is some of the greatest fertilizer that is going to allow you to bloom even stronger on the other side. And I think that when we can understand that, it gets us out of our victim mentality because yeah, all of us have overcome some really crappy things. And unfortunately, I can guarantee that we're not through all of the crap that's going to be dealt to us. There's still a lot more struggle that I have ahead of me. I know that. But what I understand now is that in the thick of it, yeah, it stinks. But I also know that every hard thing I've ever walked through has always fertilized and nourished me for my greatest growth on the other side of it. And I think that when we can get in that mindset of, you know, handling our own bullshit, I think it allows us to continue to grow in leaps and bounds and have that continued growth mindset throughout the rest of our lives.
Yeah, most certainly. And I, you know, it's, a lot of that's in hindsight, isn't it? Once you look back and you go, oh yeah, that sucked at the time. But I think if you haven't ever had that yet, trying to wrap your head around that is a harder thing. But when you look back, you know, when you're aware of it and you look back and you go, oh yeah, I remember that sucked, but then this opportunity arose out of that. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to do if you can look back and you've seen the number of times it's actually happened.
Yeah, I agree.
So I wrote something down that you said here a little while ago when you talked about your own deep personal work. What sort of stuff did you do?
This is a good question because I think the ways that I continue to get to know myself change and evolve as I learn new things. And I think what I've come to realize is that knowing myself is not about finding out what the thing is and being able to put it into an elevator speech and tell someone. What I think I've discovered is that knowing myself is a continuous journey of staying compassionately curious. And I love the words compassionately curious because it holds space for ourselves to think without judgment and to continue to ask questions and explore more. And I think for me, so much of the deeper work, especially that I worked on this last year, was a lot of coming back home to its inner child work, right? It's about coming home to the version of myself that I was when I was wholly confident in myself before the world taught me to be otherwise, before the world taught me to feel shame and comparison and overthink things. And I think for a lot of us, there is so much that we can glean from coming back to that younger version of ourselves. And I know that has been a really big thing for me. You know, one simple example of that is in this last year, I would say that I've really been able to find more of my own personal style. And people always comment to me like, oh my gosh, Kaya, I love like your bright, bold outfits. And you just have so much confidence in yourself. And I was looking at pictures of myself when I was little the other day, and I found me wearing this yellow jumper, and it is covered in all of these like ridiculous flowers and whatnot. And that day I happened to be wearing a bright yellow dress covered in all of these Western scenes. And I put the two pictures up next to each other and I thought, oh, the style that I've found that I feel most authentically myself is actually just wearing the same things I really, really loved when I was a little girl. Before I tried to fit in, before I tried to, you know, wear things that were most flattering and made me look smaller. And I think like that's just one simple example of what that personal work can help you do. And so that has been really, really helpful for me. And I would say that journaling was a really big part of my personal development journey in helping me practice that self-awareness and helping me realize what are the stories that I am telling myself. Are they true? Are they helpful? Are they kind? Do I want to choose to believe a different story? That was transformational for me. Now, however, the way that I journal has really shifted this year specifically and has been really helpful in helping me connect to that deeper spiritual part of me. I listened to this podcast. It was the We Can Do Hard Things podcast with Glennon Doyle, and they had the author Elizabeth Gilbert on the show. And Elizabeth Gilbert is an author. She wrote Eat, Pray, Love. And she shared about this journaling practice, and she calls it Letters to Love. And essentially what it is you get out your journal and you simply ask the question. You can call it whatever you want. You can call it God, source, universe. She calls it love. And I really resonate with that. And you simply write at the top of your paper, you say, love, what would you have me know today? And it's basically you tapping into the kindest, wisest part of yourself. Because I believe that whatever you will call it, I think that God, love exists in all of us and all around us. And so instead of outsourcing our intuition and outsourcing what we should do to other people, it's a way to reconnect with the wisest, most loving part of you, the love, the God within you, to offer yourself that wisdom. And so I started this practice at the beginning of this year, just love, what would you have me know today? And I never know what the heck is going to come out on the pages. And I know that seems wild to say, and I think you don't understand it until you try the practice, but I would publish a collection of these love letters because every single one of them is so deeply kind and loving and beautiful. And I think the most powerful thing is realizing, oh my gosh, all of this wisdom and this love and this perspective always exists within me, but how often am I quiet enough to listen and allow it to guide me? And I would say that is a big part of my personal development journey this year, is just tapping into that own inner wisdom and inner knowing.
Mm. Elizabeth Gilbert's Letters to Love. Have you ever read the book that she wrote, Big Magic?
Yes, I actually just read it again this last year. So good.
It's one of those got to read it again books, isn't it?
It really is. So good. I love her perspective on creativity.
Mm, yeah. And yeah, it's interesting, you know, her perspective on creativity. So my wife is binge watching Suits right now. I don't know if you've ever seen Suits, but they're, you know, they're lawyers, but there was one on plagiarism, or, you know, someone had stolen someone's work or something or other. But if you listen to Big Magic, you're kind of like, I don't know if you could actually take someone to court for plagiarism anymore, because these ideas the universe puts out there and they give them to you. And if you don't want it, it'll take it away and give it to someone else. And so, yeah. It's almost like, you know, like there's a story in the book about a singer-songwriter who writes a song in his head and never puts it down on paper, but has the melody and the lyrics and the whole bit. And then, you know, 2 years later, he's driving along the road and his song comes on the radio, you know, word for word. And, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert has that great story about the book she was going to write, and then mm-hmm. her friend ends up writing it. Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, I love that. That idea of magic, of that sort of magic, that sort of tapping into, you know, source, whatever. And yeah, it's pretty cool. I had a lady on the podcast who, she's from Oregon. She's like in her mid-30s, white girl from Oregon in her mid-30s. And suddenly she started downloading, she became a mystic Sufi poet. She was in Israel on a tour, and she was in a jail cell meditating, and suddenly she started downloading poetry, and now she writes. She's a mystic Sufi poet, and just stuff comes to her, and she's got to write it down.
That is so fascinating to me. So fascinating to me. You know, I think it's funny because I feel like the older I get, the more woo-woo I get. And I feel like my husband teases me and my mom teases me about it, but I just feel like the more open I am to spirituality in a bigger form than maybe the way I was learned what spirituality was. And I think also, I just love the word magic. And I think one of the things that I actually share in a lot of my marketing is helping women tap into their own inner magic. And I think that there is something so beautiful in it. And I think for me, as part of this journey of tapping into my own inner magic, I think it's part of it is allowing the things that bring me joy to guide me in my life, especially as a solopreneur. You know, I think that sometimes I feel like, am I just like, is it a problem that I have all these different passions and my business continues to take different directions? Or is it one of the favorite questions I ask myself lately is, what if it's not a problem? Just for a lot of different situations. Whenever I feel shame or concern about something, I ask myself first, like, what if this is not a problem? For example, I struggle with, I would say I'm a chronic procrastinator. I always have been since I was a little girl, and I continue to be. And I've felt a lot of shame about that, right? Because you're supposed to plan things out and have things done ahead of time. That's what good girls are supposed to do. I was recently diagnosed with ADHD though, and that's been really, really helpful in just having more self-awareness. And I just recently have allowed myself to decide that doing things at the last minute with excellence is actually not a problem, and I don't have to feel any shame about it anymore. But in my business, I've been really focused on allowing things that bring me joy and excite me creatively to guide me, because there are no rules, right? All the rules in this world are made up. And I think what's been really, really cool about it is allowing myself to have more creative freedom with things that excite me and my passions. And this year I've pursued some things, or I guess I should say over the past couple of years, I've pursued some things in my business that have just really lit my soul on fire. And I feel like when I get excited, that is when I do my best work. That's when I end up falling into the place of my purpose, like you've been mentioning throughout the show. And one of those passion projects was, I love agriculture. I love traveling. I love storytelling. And one of my dear friends, Courtney Dehoff, she grew up on a ranch in Kansas, and she would be a great person for you to talk to on the show. Her life has taken her all over the world, and she lives in Dallas, Texas now. And she did a lot of broadcast media, and I had a long layover once in Dallas. And so she picked me up. We went to lunch, and we were eating pasta and drinking wine, which is where a lot of the best ideas are formed, in my opinion. And we were talking about how, man, we would love to have our own TV show one day. We both love speaking. We love agriculture. We love traveling. And I looked at her and I thought, why don't we just create our own TV show? You know, instead of waiting for someone to just stumble upon us and discover us, YouTube is free. Why don't we just make our own show? And so that same day, over wine and pasta, we already had a name for it. We called it Backroad Cowgirls. And within a month and a half, we had rented a van off of someone on Instagram from San Diego. And we were traveling around the state of California for 2 weeks in this old Euro van, telling stories of people in agriculture. And by the end of our road trip, we had put together 16 stories, diverse people, diverse aspects of agriculture, and we shared them on YouTube. We called it Backroad Cowgirls. And we had so much fun. The number one rule we had at the beginning of that project was, we are only going to continue doing this if we are having a fun time doing it. And we shared it all on social media. And there was these two women that reached out to us. They worked for Simplot Grower Solutions based in Idaho. And they said, hey, we love this project. How can we get involved? And Courtney and I were like, well, we'd love to make this an official pilot episode. And so fast forward, Simplot Grower Solutions came on board to fully fund the professional production of a pilot episode. So we shot the episode this last October in Utah, and we are currently in the very final stages of editing, and we're getting ready to pitch it to networks this next month. And our goal with this is really to elevate the stories of agriculture, get them in front of mainstream audiences that maybe have no personal tie to agriculture, but more than anything, We don't want it to be an educational show where we say, this is how your food is raised. We want it to be a human show where we talk about the hearts and the people themselves in agriculture. So that, because that's where people connect, right? People connect with people. And by osmosis, maybe they'll learn and have this new appreciation for agriculture. But it has been such a fun project, and that would have never gotten as far as it has had I not given myself permission to follow that joy and that passion and that, I guess, creative freedom.
You know what? You mentioned a recent ADHD diagnosis, and don't you think that's part of your superpower?
Absolutely. I think one of the main reasons I actually pursued, I never even considered that I had ADHD. My best friend happens to be a therapist, which is a very convenient thing to have a therapist for a best friend, I've got to say. But she just asked me one day, have you ever considered that you might have ADHD? And I thought, no, that's ridiculous. And then I fell down a rabbit hole of learning more about how many women are undiagnosed because women present so much differently. And as I started digging into this more, I thought, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. I just resonated with all of it so deeply. And one of the reasons that I pursued getting diagnosed was because, and this is interesting, I know that I was able to be compassionate towards myself without a diagnosis, but I think I was seeking a diagnosis as kind of like this validation of, am I making this up? Is this real for me? And if this is true for me, oh my gosh, again, what if it's not a problem? What if my brain just operates differently? And what if that's actually one of the reasons that I thrive in all of these areas? It has been actually very freeing for me to understand more about that.
Yeah. Don't you think even if you didn't do anything with the diagnosis, like you didn't change anything, you would actually change your story about yourself, like you understand where it came from. And so I've had a number of these over the years to where you understand where, you know, some of your stuff comes from, and it's there for a reason. You know, like from traumas or whatever, it's not that you decided to be that way. I've found that once that happens, then you give yourself a lot more grace about that particular part of you. So even if you don't change anything, you do change a lot because the story about yourself changes.
100%. I think that's been the biggest light bulb moment for me is also, and I think also realizing that, oh, I don't have to fit the mold of what, you know, I've should on myself a lot in my life, you know, like what I should be doing and how I should be doing business and how I should be operating. And I think it's given me more grace and compassion for, oh, my brain just works differently and I don't have to fit myself or my business into a certain cookie cutter mold of how things need to be done. I can actually make it work for me and my brain and how I best operate. And again, it's not actually a problem. I agree with you. Like you said earlier, I think that it's actually a really beautiful superpower.
Yeah, I've just finished a book called ADHD, A Hunter in a Farmer's World. And it talks about how ADHD tendencies were good when we were hunter-gatherers, but as we turned into farming, you know, farmers can, like, I can plant the corn, I can do the one thing all day long, whereas hunters have to be able to change focus a lot. And it was, this lady basically divides the world into two people, hunters and farmers. And if you're a hunter, you have, and it was a fascinating, fascinating book. You know, and she talked a lot about, say entrepreneurs, you know, a hunter's mindset's good, but she was saying that a hunter tends to start a good business, but once it gets to a certain point, you almost need a farmer to take over.
You need to
have someone with a different mindset to take over. I remember I read a book years ago and I can't remember what it was about, but the title's catchy. It was What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And that was almost like, okay, being a hunter got you here, but being a hunter won't get you there.
I love that perspective. I'm actually really fascinated. I want to look into that book. I think it's interesting too. My husband does not have ADHD and he has a very, I don't know if you've ever dug into human design at all. Are you familiar with human design?
A little bit. Yes.
So we do not have to go down the rabbit hole, and I'm not an expert on human design either, but learning what my human design was, I am, in that framework, I'm a projector and my husband is what's known as a generator. So yeah, of course I am. And projectors are supposed to be like the guides of this world, which really checks out for what I do, professionally. It makes sense why I was drawn to that. And my husband, he is a generator, or I guess he's a manifesting generator, but generators are, they're the farmers, right? They're the ones that can work a 9-to-5, very structured, put your head down and get things done. And I think learning about our differences has really helped me communicate why I do things differently and why he's frustrated with certain things. And I understand why he's frustrated. And just because the way that we operate and think is so different. And I don't think it's bad. I think it's actually beautiful in helping us understand in our relationships how other people think. And we need all kinds of kinds, because I need my husband who can put his head down and focus for 8 hours straight to help us in our house operate and not have it be a scattered mess, because my brain is just thinks so differently. And I really want to read that book. I think that'd be really, really helpful for me.
It's a good book. You know, it's interesting that you had a therapist say, have you ever thought that you might have ADHD? So back during COVID, when we were stuck at home, I don't think my wife and I had ever spent that much time together. So we both, so there's basically no separation between business and personal, because we, you know, we both do the same thing and we're in the same house. And so we were struggling. So we took some online therapy, and one day during one of those sessions, the therapist says to me, you ever thought you might have ADHD? I'm like, no. Yeah. And I've never had a proper diagnosis, but I've had a number of therapists go, yeah, I think you might be a bit,
you know, and I think
I'm, go ahead.
I was just going to say, my friend, the therapist, actually had talked to me about this, because I told her that I really wanted to get diagnosed, and she sent me this really great podcast. I wish I could remember which show it was on now, but it was from a woman with ADHD, and she basically empowered people to say, you don't need a diagnosis from a professional to know that you're ADHD if you know that you're ADHD. Like, it doesn't make it any less valid because you didn't get someone to sign a piece of paper that said so. So that also was helpful for me too, of being like, okay, I can know myself and know that this is the case. And I'm sure the same thing is true for you. If you're like, yes, I have ADHD, it doesn't take necessarily a diagnosis to make that true or valid.
Yeah. And I'm not looking for a diagnosis so I can say, hey, I'm ADHD, but it does help you understand yourself more. And I think it also helps you give yourself a bit more grace about the way you act.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I feel that very deeply.
Mm. Yeah. So you mentioned inner child work before. I've been doing some IFS type stuff. Fascinating subject, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And I think it's been one of the most eye-opening things for me to explore and to heal. And just like a lot of forgiveness work, a lot of self-compassion work, a lot of reparenting work. And I'm curious if my husband and I hope to expand our family eventually, if that's, you know, the journey that we're meant for. And I am hopeful that doing all this personal development work on myself now will help me once I become a parent, knowing that as a parent, I'm still going to do things wrong and still mess up in so many ways. But I'm grateful that I'm able to do a lot of this healing work for myself now in reflection to my childhood too.
Yeah. Don't you feel that doing that makes you a better parent? Because, you know, all our parents were doing the best they could at the time.
Of course.
And you start to unravel, like, some of your shit comes from the tiniest little thing, like little T traumas, not big T traumas. Like
100%.
You know, you can avoid the big T traumas, but like I thought I had the perfect childhood. You know what I mean?
Same.
And then you get to a certain age and you're like, I feel like I'm as messed up as somebody who had some bad stuff happen. And you start to look into all these little T traumas and you start to understand how much the little things make a huge difference. And you start to understand things like, you start to understand things like having a child in another room and crying themselves to sleep is the start of lifelong nervous system dysregulation. You know what I mean? Like just little things like that, like, you know, little stuff that we would, and I was reading a book a while ago and I forget what the book was about, but there was a part in it where they were talking about how they went around the world and they did studies on children. They drew blood on all these children and ran tests to, you know, see what was in there sort of thing. But there were these kids in Uganda that had protein levels that were off the charts compared to most other kids in the world, like in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought, well, I wonder what they're eating that the other kids aren't eating. So they looked into the diets and they couldn't figure out anything. And they finally realized that these children as infants are never put down. They're always held close to a human body. So if you think about, we evolved to actually be raised that way. And if we are raised that way, our protein levels, these good protein levels that we're supposed to have, are there. But if we're put down a lot and, you know, crib whatever, those protein levels aren't there. We're not functioning the same way we should be functioning. You know, you think about it, all of us have dysregulated nervous systems. If we were ever put in another room to cry yourself to sleep, your nervous system is dysregulated from step one sort of thing. You know what I mean? And understanding those things, think about what a gift that is. If you're going to have kids, understanding those things, like those little things that we, you know, you just kind of would take for granted if you hadn't done this inner child work.
Yeah.
You know, just understandings of those little things, how big a difference that can make 30 years down the track.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's, and you know, you talking about the little T traumas. I think that that's one of the conversations that I hope continues to change, because I think there are so many people that I talk to about like therapy or mindset work. And they're like, well, I didn't have anything bad happen to me. I'm like, it's not about the big stuff. Like, yes, I'm grateful that I do not have a lot of big T traumas in my life. But I think that everyone can use therapy, because all of us have little T traumas that impact our life and we are just blissfully unaware. And maybe I shouldn't say blissfully, maybe it's not always so blissful, but I just think that it's normal for us to go to a regular doctor at least once a year for a checkup. And it's not normal quite yet for you to go and see a therapist to focus on your mental health quite yet. But I do think it's going in the right direction. And I think what a difference it will be for the next generation if that continues to be more a part of the conversation.
Yeah, it's certainly a topic of conversation. And you were saying earlier on that my family was the same too, but as a kid, emotions weren't talked about.
Yeah.
Which means if you had some, you couldn't talk about them. Have you ever heard of Gabor Maté?
I have not.
Gabor Maté is a Canadian doctor who's one of the world's leading experts in trauma.
Okay.
He's written some really good books, but one of them is called The Myth of Normal, probably one of the best books I've ever listened to. But in there, someone was telling him, well, I don't have any trauma. And he said, when you were a child, did you have an adult you could go to and tell them exactly how you were feeling with no judgment? Like you could express whatever emotions you were feeling or whatever you wanted to talk about. Did you have someone you could go to and do that? And the guy said no. And he goes, that's your trauma right there.
That's good. That's good.
You know what I mean? As a child, being able to go to someone, an adult, and tell them exactly what's on your mind. Like for me, it was dogs and horses.
Yeah.
That I would talk to.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons why horses are so healing for so many people. You know, I think in my family, I'm grateful that my parents were more open, but with my extended family, and I think that maybe this is something not just generationally, but also culturally, growing up in the Western space and in agriculture, I think that we were taught like, rub some dirt in it. If you're crying, I'll give you something to cry about. Like, toughen up, suck it up. And I see the way that with my dad's generation, that has had ripple effects that have torn apart families, that has led to a lot of alcoholism because there was never a space for them to show any emotions besides being tough. And when I think about my grandparents, I'd never seen my grandparents cry. And I think that, you know, we just lost my grandpa in 2022 and he was the best person. And my grandma wouldn't allow herself to grieve in front of her own kids and her own family because she didn't want to show weakness. And I just couldn't help but think that right there is the problem. That right there is the problem. Because it didn't give her kids permission to grieve either.
Yeah, that and just, I think stuck emotions in the body actually manifest as illness.
Yes, absolutely. They're all connected.
And you know, these were not topics of conversations that, you know, that were around years ago. I was talking to a lady last year whose husband had had, I think he had throat cancer. Mm-hmm. And then he got over that and he doesn't smoke, but then he got lung cancer. And the doctor that she was seeing, who is from somewhere in the northern part of South America, one of those countries in there, was saying that so fear of death, that emotion lodges itself in the liver. And she said that the liver cancer was actually the trauma from the fear of death from the throat cancer.
That is fascinating.
So it's a secondary cancer. And the guy doesn't smoke. So it's a secondary cancer from an emotion. And so in this whole topic of conversation, there was a few of us in this conversation, we kind of looked at each other and went, what if cancer is caused by unhealed stuck emotions?
That is fascinating.
But you know, I think it'll be, yeah, I'm really into like the whole, you know, mind, body, spirit sort of thing these days, but stuck emotions, manifesting as other things, I think is something I'm quite fascinated about these days.
Yeah. I think it is a fascinating thing. And I think that we're just going to start to learn more and more about it. And it's going to be so, so interesting to see what we know 20 years from now versus what we know today. You know, years ago, they also thought that smoking wasn't bad for you. And so just to think about how much more we know now versus past generations and what we're going to find out moving forward is going to be so interesting.
Well, speaking of smoking, so I went and saw a Native American shaman a number of years ago, and he was telling me that, and this comes back to if you think the wheatgrass is going to reject, your body's going to reject the wheatgrass or whatever. He was saying that traditionally tobacco smokers didn't, like indigenous tobacco smokers, didn't get any negative side effects from it because of the intention with which they were smoking it.
Interesting.
It wasn't a habit. It wasn't a habit. It wasn't a crutch.
Right, like a way to numb.
Okay. Yes, it wasn't a way to numb. It was actually, you know, the smoke communes with the spirits. And it was, there was a totally different reason for doing it.
That's fascinating.
It wasn't a numbing thing. And he said people didn't get cancers from tobacco then. So it's like, wow, that's another way of looking at stuff.
That is super interesting.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you think about intentions and stuff.
Yeah. I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Socrates, some philosopher. And I think that the quote is, I'm going to say it wrong, but I think they said something like, I'm intelligent because I know that I know nothing. And I think that is the energy in which I walk through the world now. I think that there are just, the more I know, the more questions I have about all sorts of things. And I think, again, that's why compassionate curiosity has kind of become like a mantra for me in my own life, to continue to be compassionately curious about myself, about the world, about other people, because I don't know if any of us know anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, the more you know, the more answers you get, the more questions you have.
100%.
But isn't it exciting to when you start to understand these things, how much of an energy there is in your judgments and your perceptions and all that sort of thing. And you can start to, once you become aware of that, then you can start to change your thoughts about things. And I think that's where the magic happens.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And I just feel like expansive. I think that's what it makes you. It makes you more expansive and open-minded to other people and other stories and other beliefs. And I just think it's a really healthy way to explore the world and yourself too.
Yeah. I remember when I first started seeing the term trauma-informed and I thought, what does that mean? But you know, I've now come to understand it that once you understand your own traumas and how they manifested in your body or in your actions or in your thoughts, it gives you a lot more grace about other people who are having a bad day or showing up a certain way. You don't think that guy's been a dick. You tend to think, oh, I wonder what past
what pain
things
he's feeling.
Have. Yes. Yeah, yeah, most certainly. And I think it makes you more empathetic, both of yourself, but of others as well.
Absolutely. I think I've come to, you know, it's interesting about how learning how that we can change the stories we tell ourselves. I think it's also made it easier to change the story I tell myself about other people. And I think people that get really defensive or angry about other people tend to take things personally. And, you know, I think when someone else does something or says something, we have no idea what their intention or thought process is behind it. And so if let's say that someone cuts me off or says something really hateful on the side of the street, and I don't know who they are, and they say something really awful, some people might be like, oh my gosh, like they need to be served justice. They need to be told off again too. Like that is so uncalled for. And my approach to the world, not that it's right or wrong, or it's just different, is I always choose to tell myself a story since all I know is a story. I don't know the truth. I just tell myself a story that makes me feel good about like, they're just having a really hard day. This actually has absolutely nothing to do with me. Even if it does have everything to do with me, I don't know the true story. So I might as well tell myself a story that makes me feel pretty good.
You know, it's like Brené Brown says that
the story I'm telling myself is.
No, not that one. Well, that's true too, but no, he says, I always assume that the others are doing the best that they can.
Yes, I love that.
He said, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but it certainly makes my day better.
100%. And at the end of the day, that's all that we can do. I think that so many of us operate in the world allowing other people's actions or inactions or words affect us so deeply. And it's because of the story we're choosing to allow ourselves to believe. And I love Brené Brown. She is one of my favorites of all time.
She's awesome. So something I want to ask you more from a personal level from me is you are accidentally famous, meaning you didn't set out to be in the public eye.
Yeah.
Have you had your struggles with that, like with negative criticism in a public space? Have you struggled with that?
Yes, I have. And, you know, it's interesting because I remember waking up. I remember there was a man, I'll give you one example. There was a man who had sent me a message, an email, and he said, hey, Kaya, I had just been named like the 2020 Beef Advocate of the Year, this award and honor from the beef industry. And I had this reporter email me and say, hey, Kaya, I saw that you were just recently named, you know, Advocate of the Year. And I just wanted to ask you a few questions about beef cattle and climate change or something. And I was like, I don't know who this guy is. I'm not sure. And of course, like a lot of journalists, he said, I would love to talk to you by 2 p.m. today. And I just had a slammed day. And so I just ignored the email. And the next morning I wake up and on my Instagram, I have my very first death threats in my DMs. And I open up an article and this gentleman from Vice News had written an article about me. And all it said was influencer says she lost 120 pounds eating beef and she worked for Big Beef. And it was this essentially a huge slam article about me and the beef industry. And my first reaction was like, oh my gosh, like this is horrible. This is my worst fear. I can't believe this. All of these people are... My Instagram was flooded on every single post that had anything to do with ranching or the beef industry. I mean, just flooded. And my first reaction was like shock and, you know, and my husband who has, he works more on the lobbying side of things and in agriculture. And his reaction was, congratulations, babe. And I was like, what are you talking about? He says, if people are talking bad about you, that means that what you're saying is making an impact. And I just was like, okay, that's a perspective shift. That makes me feel a little bit better. That's one way to think about it. The louder you are and the more passionate you are, the more haters you're going to have as well. And so I think honestly, that instance was a really great help, like really, really helpful for me. But I think something that I've really struggled with over the past couple of years is so much of the reason that I became, you know, quote unquote, accidentally famous was because of this health journey and these before and after pictures. And a lot of people started following me because of the weight loss story. And so it had kind of made my body a part of the conversation. And my body continued to be part of the conversation. And so I would get messages from people about like, how can you keep talking about, you know, being a life coach when you've so clearly gained weight back? And that really felt like a gut punch to me because it was this instance of, oh my gosh, look, the world is showing up the way that I always expected it to, which is think less of me because of my body changing. And, you know, I love that we were just talking about the conversation of we get to create the story of what's going on in somebody else's mind. And because I did all this work on myself, I realized, oh, this criticism is coming from a person who has not yet allowed themselves to accept themselves in their own body. And that really helped me navigate that with so much more love and kindness. And I actually went on this, like, I don't want to call it a rant because a rant makes it sound angry, but I went on my Instagram stories. I just, as I was getting ready, I just talked off the cuff about like this instance of someone messaging me and how my brand has shifted and evolved. And that woman ended up messaging me afterwards saying, I actually really, really appreciate the work that you're doing. And thank you for showing us what it looks like to love and accept yourself. And this is work I need to do on myself. And I just like, that was a really awesome moment for me in knowing that it's hard to be a public figure and to be a human humaning in the public eye with all these eyes on you. But when I allow more space for my own humanness and other people's humanness, there is so much collective healing and learning that we can have together.
Okay. Well, let's wrap it up. So now is when you tell everybody, how do we find Coach Kaya?
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I do feel like I could sit here and chat with you for 5 more hours. I feel like we have a lot in common. For anyone that wants to connect with me, you can find me on my website, coachkaya.com. It's Coach K-I-A-H, like the car with an H at the end, coachkaya.com. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook as Coach Kaya. Instagram is probably currently my favorite place to hang out. And if you want to get my weekly musings, you can hop on my email list on my website as well. I send out an email every Wednesday, and I would love to see you over there.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a fascinating conversation. Love what you're doing in the world. Keep it up.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
And you guys at home, thanks for listening. And we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.